I've got the new iPad Pro, 11-inch, and the new Apple Pencil, and the new Smart Keyboard Folio. Mine arrived, we're recording on Thursday, mine arrived on Wednesday afternoon, so I've had like right at 24 hours experience with it. And so, you know, so far so good, but happy to talk about it, Mayo. And, you know, I know you're sitting this one out, so any questions you have, kind of thing.
Yeah, sure. I'm pretty jealous. It's definitely pretty. You want to give like a rough overview of what you think about it at the moment?
Yeah, I'll just say at the top, like I was messaging you yesterday, 24 hours ago, like right before it arrived, I was having serious like FOMO, fear of missing out on the not getting the bigger size. Mostly because our colleague Ben Lovejoy has posted, you know, his ongoing experience with his 12.9-inch, and it just looks really good, like showing two full size side by side apps together. It just had me thinking, oh man, maybe I bought the wrong one. Like I cheaped out. I should have spent $1,000 instead of $800. And I was like looking at availability of like the accessories and stuff. I was like, okay. Maybe I'll just exchange it if I don't like it. I've got a few days. But mine arrived, and I'm happy to report back that 11-inch I am totally happy with. I don't think I'll like get over that. I think it's, you know, pretty set. Because coming from 9.7-inch iPad Pro, like it's a bigger screen. And, you know, it's just like when if you upgrade your phone screen size, you always appreciate, unless you get too big, you appreciate that it's still manageable and you can see more stuff. And with the 11-inch, I think it's kind of remarkable how the physical footprint is so much like the original iPad and the original iPad Pro 9.7-inch, and I guess last year's 10.5-inch. Like, there's not a whole lot of footprint difference. It's just the screen is bigger. So with that, I'm really happy because, you know, bigger screen, but it's not a way bigger body. So I'm happy. You're a 12.9-inch person, so you wouldn't want to downgrade, I guess, right?
Yes. I mean, we spoke about this before, so I don't want to repeat it, but it's like, for me, it's at least $1,000 to start because I don't want to go to a smaller screen. Like, I see any of the other iPads and they look tiny. It's like the 12.9 is massive in terms of chassis size, so no doubt this one would be a lot more palatable and, you know, carrying around stuff, but I generally use it in one room at like in the morning and at night, and you know, $1,000 entry, because then I've also probably got to buy a pencil as well, and then some sort of case. So I tend not to like the keyboard cases stuff because it's just not really how I use the iPad at the moment, but still, that's more. And then it's, then do I really want 64? And then you know, you can very quickly go up the scale, and it's like,
yeah,
at that point I'm sitting on the sidelines for the time being.
So for me, I priced out what my iPad Pro in 2016 cost me, and the iPad was $600. The keyboard, the Smart Keyboard, was $150, and the pencil was $100. And then the back case, silicon case, was $70. So all in all, it was like right around $916. And then this time around, it's $800 for the iPad, so $200 more. $180 for the Smart Keyboard Folio, so $20 more there, and then $130 for the new Apple Pencil, $30 more there. And there's no back case, but the Folio kind of gives you the back coverage, just not like side protection, and it's not really like a case like the silicon case was, where it protects it from drops. It's just like, you know, back coverage.
Yeah, like the edges are exposed, right, on this new Folio.
Yeah, and I mean, the magnets, it's not falling out of there, but it's also not going to, like, keep it from shattering the glass, I don't think, or like denting the corners. So it's not quite a comparison there, but the price difference was $916 in 2016 and $1,107 now, and that's with losing some of that protection. You pay almost $200 more and you get a little less protection. But again, I'm going from the base model to the base model, from the 9.7-inch iPad Pro to the 11-inch iPad Pro, and the storage difference is 32 to 64. A9X chip to A12X chip, and that includes 2 gigabytes of RAM to 4 gigabytes of RAM. And one of the big things for me has been like not just the 1.3-inch screen size increase, but the ProMotion 120Hz refresh rate, because that was on last year's iPad Pro, but I never got it. So now that, like, that's a new thing for me too.
Yeah, the 120 is, it's so nice. It's like, your phone can be as fast as where you can have the latest phone, and it'll still feel way slower than even like last year's iPad, just because of the scrolling performance of getting twice the number of frames in every same second. The whole analogy of iOS devices where you're directly moving content like one to one, it just makes that so much better. And the 120 stuff is really what I think they should bring to the phone. I mean, they wanted to bring to the phones this year, but still problematic on OLED. They probably could have done it on the 10R if it wasn't meant to be the cheaper phone in the line, because then it'd be really weird to have it, you know, the promotion on the 751 and then not the 1000. But I really hope they've got like promotion on OLED in the wings, and also then deploy it out to the next round of laptops and desktops and iMacs and stuff.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's the speed is like the processor speed is something you see whenever you're gameplay or like processing like a video edit, you know, stuff like that. But just like scrolling a web page or going between home screens, like the way that looks so fast is like, it isn't the speed, but it's like the refresh rate, and that makes it feel faster. It's the same way like on my Mac, I always change the tracking speed for the mouse or the trackpad, because like the default is just way too slow, and it makes
the default
my
is
Mac
way
feel
too
better.
Slow.
Yeah,
yeah. The because my brother has a 2017 iPad Pro, so I just flick about on it sometimes, and the 120 hertz performance. It this is going to be kind of a weird analogy, but it's like, you know, if you watch on a movie and they have like a simulated laptop, and you can tell the screen's like CGI. And then they're like waving their hands in front of it like a sci-fi film, and then it just moves along. It almost feels like that. It doesn't feel like it's rendering anything, because it's just so continuous. And whenever it does drop out, you really notice it. Like, people are, this is one of the things that like iOS 12 kind of helps in a way, in that when people started mentioning, oh, iOS 11, iOS 10, they kept having all these frame drops and weird lags. Like, the kind of refocus on performance in iOS 12 obviously was aimed at, you know, making older users, you know, customers with older devices happy, but it also lays better foundations as they ramp up the refresh rates and stuff, because then that filters down. Like, rendering 120 frames every second is not trivial. Like, if you actually think about how long the iPad has to render each frame before it's going to skip one, it's not very long. So anything they can do, especially like the auto layout performance stuff, it really helps tune up the amount of time that it can actually render at 120. And on the new iPad Pros, you generally can stick there for a long it will go down. Like, you can see it like in maps and stuff sometimes when you're going in the 3D stuff. It definitely doesn't keep to a 120 like locked forever. But if you're on mail or browsing the web and stuff, they've really done a good job at keeping it there, and it just feels so good. It's hard to describe, but it just feels so good to use.
Yeah, another thing, I wrote a hands-on thing today about the upgrade experience from the original iPad Pro 9.7 inch to the 11 inch iPad Pro. As I briefly had the 12.9 inch iPad Pro, but whenever the 9.7 inch came out, I downgraded, or however you want to say it. And that's been my iPad for the last 2 years. This is interesting, the size and the weight difference. So the 9.7 inch iPad Pro is 6.1 millimeters thick, thin, however that's the depth, and then both of the new iPad Pros are 5.9 inches, and it's like
millimeters.
Yeah, millimeters.
Inches.
If that was inches, that would be like Samsung.
That would definitely classify as thick, not thin.
Yeah. And it's like that difference is, to me, not perceptible. Like, I think that's the same difference as like the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus. Those had that amount of difference too. I think like 0.2 millimeters. At this big screen size, I just don't feel it. And the funny thing is that the 9.7-inch iPad Pro is a little bit lighter than the 11-inch. It's 0.97 pounds compared to 1.03 pounds. So really small amount there. But it's like, I thought that the new iPad was actually going to be lighter based on just like feeling it without looking at the specs. And it feels like hollow inside. It feels like it's just like this box, the screen, and like nothing inside of it, whereas the old iPad Pro felt dense and like evenly weighted. And I think that's the difference, is that it's just like the weight to size ratio, it just feels better on the new iPad. So even though it's a little bit heavier, it feels like it isn't. And it's like some kind of an illusion at play, just based on like how it's distributed and how dense it is. I don't know.
Yeah, like the screen gets bigger disproportionately more than the weight changes, or at least to the perception of you holding it.
And that's where the bezels, like, I mean, the chin and forehead bezel especially, it's like, it's functionally, like, it's nice to have that gone, but it also plays, and you know, this effect that you have. Once you put accessories, like any of the keyboard cases on, like, none of that matters because those are bulkier and heavier. But just, like, the raw iPad itself, which I often use it that way, it feels really nice. The other thing is both iPads that I have are space gray, and if you look at my story, it's dramatically differently colored. And I mean, it's no surprise to us. Like, Michael Stever had his excellent, like, exploration through all the shades of space gray.
Yeah.
But this is just, like, night and day difference. Like, you would think it's, like, silver and space gray instead of what it is.
What do you think about the look, like the squared off edges and stuff? That kind of
aesthetic. A lot of people are saying like this is like the nicest looking and feeling iOS device ever, and I think that is just like maybe the fact that it's new and it's a new design that people are like really attracted to it. But I think that the iPhone X, you know, and for that matter, like the XS and XS Max have the best iOS device like premium feel and design. I mean, stainless steel versus aluminum, glass, you know, it's really nice. OLED. This is like, I don't think it looks bad. It's just aggressive, and it's like, I don't think this is the, like, whereas like the iPhone feels like they've almost got like a watch level design. The iPad feels like it's definitely function first, like the bands, the smart connector in the back, which is really big and like not color matching, the larger camera, which is still a bulge, you know, but it's like smoother looking. Like, there's just a lot about it that is not pretty to me. It's kind of like more aggressive looking, I think.
It's sort of like industrial.
Yeah
Like, I now, disclaimer, I haven't seen any of the new iPad Pros or the new Macs in person.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of get the feeling that it's like one step before the end of the finishing process. Like, that kind of, it kind of looks like a block of like raw aluminium that, you know, Johnny Ive would get out sometimes and be like, here's our unibody. We start with this raw block of aluminium and then we mill it down. It's like, well, yeah, with this iPad Pro, we got this raw block of aluminium and then we don't really mill it. And then here it is.
Yeah, a lot of people are saying like they want the new iPhones to look this way too. I don't know about that. Like, I think it looks neat, but it is definitely a throwback to like the first iPad and the iPhone 4 and 5. Like, they have these flat sides, and this is even like more industrial than those were. I think it's neat because it's new and different. But I think maybe years from now, we'll look back at this one as like the first version of that design, like how the iPhone 6 was. And by the time it became the iPhone 8 and 10, it looks way better. Like,
yeah. And it isn't just like a cuboid. Like, the edges are curved slightly at the very edges. Like, it is obviously thought through and stuff, but it's not, I don't think it's better than the iPhone design at the moment. Like, I think the fact what's significant to making it look good is how thin it is. I think if you went thicker, like, because the phones are a lot thicker than the iPad is, right?
Mm-hmm.
By a few millimeters. But I think that makes a big difference in the boxiness look. If it was much bigger, it would just look way too big. It would look like a pizza tray type of thing, right? Versus the kind of warm curves of the phone design, which also, because like the iPad has like the curved screen and the curved, you know, very curved corners. It just doesn't have the curved sides, which is kind of what the phone has, like the curvature all the way around it.
Yeah.
So if I was picking like my favorite looking iOS device, you'd have to pick iPhone X because XS have those asymmetric dots and the weird extra antenna lines and that rubbish.
Yeah.
And the iPhone X is like stainless steel and then like glass. Like, maybe you could argue this is the prettiest iPad they've done, but I don't think it's... I'm not like jumping at the bit for them to make an iPhone like this next year. I think it would be... Like, I look at the iPhone 5 design, which is close to what this is, right? And then you look at the iPhone X, and I think the curviness of the X just... It looks way more human and kind of matches with the curves of the edges, the curves of the screen, which then goes into the curves of like the dock and all the way down the line. Like the boxiness is kind of abrupt.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a bit like fashion, like it'll come in and out depending on like what Apple's doing that year. The boxiness of it kind of reminds me of how the MacBook Pros are all pretty thin, but they are boxy. And then,
like the bases of them, yeah.
Right, and then the MacBook and MacBook Air have tapered edges, you know, kind of like now the non-iPad Pro, except for the 10.5-inch. But, you know, that's a distinction between MacBook and MacBook Pro, and now we've got that in the same way. It's like you can't afford to shave off the edges. It needs to – like the full brick of it is like what you need to have this power. So it kind of has like a translation of like the design and like what it does. But it is different. I've not seen the silver one in person, and I'm curious how that looks compared to the space gray one, which is way darker. But I mean, things like the antenna line and the, which is, I mean, you've got a significant line on the top and bottom of the back of the Wi-Fi model. And then you have a little bit more on the LTE model.
it like finishes off to goes to the edges on the LTE.
Right? Yeah. And then you have the, like an adjacent asymmetrical extra lines for the MIMO stuff or whatever it is, you know, the gig of whatever. and then the smart connector, like, I don't know if they can't make that color matched or darker, or if it would like wear off or what, you know, but that's just like looking at the back of it, you didn't really see it on the old iPad Pro when it was on the edge, and now it's on the back. Like, I think it's a little bit bigger, and it pops out, like it doesn't blend in at all. So it's,
yeah, I guess they have to keep it like raw metal for the conduct to flow through properly. But because when I saw your, I like skimmed through your post and I saw that picture, I was like, wait, and then I looked at my iPad Pro, and obviously it's the 2015, so it's on the edge, and I've never, like, and it is the same color. It's just, I never noticed it before because it was on the side rather than being on the massive expanse of the back, which is all colored space gray otherwise.
Yeah, so I guess if you have the silver one, that looks a little bit nicer than it does on the space gray one. But yeah, the look of it, I mean, like I said, I like it because it's new and different, and it is just like neat that this is a new design for the iPad. But I'm not sure that like several years from now we'll look back at this as like the gem of the iPad design. And I'm not sure that we need this on the iPhone either. I think the iPhone is going in a good direction that's not this one. The display, I mean, to go from 9.7 inches to 11 inches is a big jump. If you have 12.9 inch iPad and you upgrade, like, you don't really get a jump there. And if you have a 10.5 inch one, maybe it's less dramatic to go to the 11. I'm sure it is. Those are both probably pretty similar. You just lose the forehead and chin. And I think if you go on the 10.5 inch iPad Pro to the 11 inch, the side bezel actually gets a little bit thicker because it was just so thin on the 10.5 inch one. But on the 9.7 inch iPad Pro, it was definitely thicker than on the new 11 inch iPad Pro. Not to mention the forehead and chin. And
yeah, the 9.7 inch basically has the same bezels the 12.9s have. And then when they did the 10.5, they made thinner bezels on the left and right sides, essentially, which are thinner than the bezels, than the left and right bezels of this one, but obviously the overall bezel is much smaller.
Total. So I'm really happy in like the situation with apps that haven't been updated. If it's made for the 12.9 inch iPad or the 10.5 inch iPad, like it looks kind of okay to me. The home indicator has a black bar around it, and the status bar has a black bar like around it. Like, these are like on the top and bottom, but you don't lose any content really. It's just like a little bit of a visual, you know, hiccup. An app like Facebook that was never been updated for even the 2015 12.9 inch iPad, it's going to have big pillars that are black on each side of the app.
Yeah, on those ones, they're literally letterboxed on all four sides. Whereas
it's almost like getting your bezel back.
Yeah, whereas the apps that have been updated for the older iPad Pros just have like the top and bottom status bar and the home indicator blacked out.
Yeah.
Whereas old ones are literally just sitting in the middle of with it just black all the way around it.
Yeah, it's really not bad on the apps that are modern but not updated for these. And I've been seeing a lot of apps update like pretty quickly. Like even Tweetbot just updated, and for the iPhones, for the XS and XR, they took like a month from the XS launch to XS Max launch to be updated, unless you're on the test flight. So that was annoying. Now they're updated on like day two, so it's pretty good.
Yeah, and The apps that are updated for the previous Pros are the ones that are far more likely to be quick in adopting the minor changes that might be necessary. Like, most apps won't even need any changes at all. They just have to resubmit. Apple doesn't want to enforce the full screen stuff just in case there are weird bits that haven't been tested and break. But the concepts are the same as designing for the phone, and you literally just have to the vast majority of apps will just be resubmitting, and that'll be the end of it. The apps you have to worry about are the ones that haven't even been updated for the old pros, which are not insignificant numbers, whether that's an iPhone app only like Instagram, or whether it's like Facebook, which is looks ridiculous on the iPad Pro and then looks ridiculous on the new iPad Pro as well. Those are the ones where they're going to be, you know, you're not going to be having an all-screen design on those apps for a long, long time.
Yeah, we were chatting yesterday about Facebook, for example, and like their app is a good iPad app, and it took them a long time to make one, but like they have an iPad app that is made well for the big screen. Like, it isn't just a blown up iPhone app.
A bit for the 9.7 inch size, it's made well.
Yeah, and they just not done the minimal amount of work I think that would be required to make it look good on the big iPad. So
yeah, because on my iPad Pro, the Facebook gets zoomed, it just gets scaled to fill, and then on yours, it's scaled and then inset a bit as well, which then makes the keyboard metrics even weirder, because not only is it a different, the keyboard's enlarged, it's also they're not starting at the edge of the glass, because obviously it's inset left and right, and that's where the keyboard stops and ends as well. So it's unfortunate. Yeah. And I really hope they can get around to it. Like, it's been 3 years, guys, since the 12.9 began, and you haven't gone anywhere with it.
Yeah, and I get that if you're a pro, maybe Facebook, the app, isn't your business, but like maybe it is if you're a professional person who uses the iPad for work, and like you need to see content on Facebook, like as it appears for other people.
And you still can't put it in a slide over or anything like that either. So, like,
right, yeah.
That's my number one slide over app or a split screen app is Twitter, like a Twitter column on the right hand side.
Yeah.
And you know, occasionally I'd want to scroll my Facebook feed as well like that, but you just can't do it because they don't even support full screen on, and they haven't updated for the split view stuff either. So it's,
yeah, Facebook, Instagram kind of looks a little bit better on the new iPad, on the 11 inch one at least, because for one, it, you know, you don't have, it's just an iPhone app zoomed up, but you don't have the top and bottom forehead and chin bezel, so you lose those like hardware black bars, and then the actual letterboxing on the left and right side is thinner because the aspect ratio changes, right? And so it can be taller. And so you get a little bit less letterboxing, and you don't have the top and bottom, you know, bezels. So
they don't rotate, right? Like the Instagram is it was only in portrait.
Right.
So you couldn't hold the iPad in landscape, and it'd be the wrong way around.
Yeah. And this has been like my thing to complain about for a while. Like, I just really want Instagram to make a nice iPad app, like any iPad app. And they have a website that can do a lot, but it's not the same. And if you think that like the website's fine, then like why bother with an app store in the first place? You know, it beautiful photos on an iPad, it's a pretty good concept, I think. They should do it.
Speaking of orientation, quickly, I obviously, as soon as you put in a keyboard cover, you force it to landscape predominantly, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of worried, like, I'm not sure whether they made the right call with putting the Face ID sensors on the left. If you're holding it in landscape and then the pencil's on the top, the Face ID stuff's on the left. And I feel it's quite natural to, like, hold the iPad in your hand and then your left hand would cover the cameras whilst your other hand actually, like, interacted with the screen. Like, maybe I'm just overthinking it, but that feels like that'd get in the way more often than not.
Right, it does, and it's especially true on the 12.9 inch. I'm sure, like, I still use my iPad, like, kind of like how Steve Jobs demoed the first iPad, you know, portrait orientation, only the iPad with no case, no keyboard around it, you know, like, hold it in your lap, browse the web, but when I use it in the keyboard case, I often find that, like, I'm tapping the screen or the keyboard and my arm or hand is in the way. It's like, you know, move your hand for Face ID. So I think at 12.9 inch, like, it's been true since 2015 that they should probably consider the default orientation landscape for that device, because, like, that's a really big device to be in portrait orientation. This week, 9to5 Mac Happy Hour is brought to you in part by OPSO, makers of the Apple MFI certified magnetic charging cable for Apple Watch. OPSO's magnetic charging cable works with all Apple Watch models from the original to the latest Series 4, including all sizes, and it has a bigger charging module surface than the charger that comes in the box, so it can be easier to connect. OPSO offers the same 1 meter, 3.3 feet cable as the original Apple Watch charger, but at a fraction of the price. For just $20.99, with free shipping available through Amazon Prime, the OPSO Apple Watch magnetic charger is nearly one-third the price of other replacement Apple Watch chargers. So if you wish you had a second Apple Watch charger at work or in your travel bag, or you need to replace one and don't want to spend more than you have to, check out OPSO's Apple Watch magnetic charging cable. I personally have one of these and keep it in my desk for days when I need to update my Apple Watch because that requires charging and at least 50% battery. And I can recommend it as a more affordable alternative than the original, and it's MFI certified, so you know it meets Apple's standards. Thanks to OPSO for sponsoring 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour. With the Apple Pencil, I mean, I have the same thoughts we had before about like the price change and the feature differences and like needing to buy a new one this time. It's too bad, but it is how it is. The ergonomic improvements are all based on feedback that everyone had immediately after the last one came out. So, you know, I'm happy about that. I've been obsessed with like finding where I can stick the magnetic Apple Pencil on the fridge, on my desk with like a metal frame around it, on the iPhone 4. It clipped to my glasses. My TV. It clipped to my TV. The part on my desk I found to be like really neat because this was like pencil, stick it there for a second, pull it off again, you know, use it. In practice, what I found to be a little weird is that I'm left-handed and I hold the iPad in my right hand when I use it in portrait orientation, like a book. And if I'm sketching, I'm writing with my left hand, sketching with my left hand, and I'm holding it with my right. And if I'm going between like sketching or annotating and like using, you know, my finger to drive navigation, I found that if the pencil magnetic charger, you know, holder was on the left side, it would be super convenient. And so if you're right-handed, it's probably super convenient to go from like using the pencil to like putting it down, which is clipping it to the side, using it, you know, picking it up again. But as a left-handed person, you've got to reach across each time. Or just keep it in your hand, you know. And it's like, it's a small thing, and I'm sure I'll get used to it, but it's just
Could hold your iPad upside down.
Yeah, some people on Twitter recommended that, and so I gave it a shot. And it of course works, and then your volume buttons are on the bottom and your power buttons on the bottom, and Face ID works in any orientation, so that's not really a problem. But if you got to do a FaceTime call, it's like a nose shot, a nostril shot. So it's like and your Apple Pencil or your Apple logo on the back is upside down, and your USB-C port is in the air. And none of that really matters, but like what I was doing at the time was playing a podcast, and like the volume didn't correct in the right way. It sounded worse upside down. So I'm not going to do that.
The magnets of the pencil were definitely designed for the landscape stuff, like using it like a landscape sketch pad. You pull it off the top center of it and then draw.
Yeah. When you're in that mode, it's not bad. I mean, it's just on top. So, and it can stick on, you know, with the pointing end facing either direction. So that's not bad. The matte finish, I mean, it's such a subtle difference, but like anything to make that thing grippier is nice compared to the original slippery one. So it's a nice change. The flat side gives it a point of like friction in your hand, so it doesn't kind of spin around in your hand as much. I would really like it if the whole, like every side of it was flat, like you know, common pencils that you can buy. I think there'd be even more friction, like grippier. But you know, the difference then is that what side is the magnetic charging side? You've got to like rotate it and figure it out. So that the way it is now is okay. It's a little bit shorter than the original Apple Pencil, like on a side by side, like same thickness, but a little bit shorter, which is good because the other one was like too long in lots of situations.
Yeah.
On the 11-inch iPad Pro, because the magnet is centered and not like adjusted for this size, no matter which direction the pencil goes in, it's kind of really close to the volume buttons too. I think this is a non-issue on the 12.9-inch, but on the 11-inch, pencil's up there, and you reach for the volume buttons, you're probably going to like, you know, tap the pencil a little bit too, like to find them. So it's just like if it were like adjusted a little bit over, not centered, it wouldn't be an issue. But it is what it is. I think that I will like using this pencil way more now because it will often be charged as long as it's attached to the iPad and often with me. it's not perfect though. Like it's still a situation where if you want to pick up the iPad from that side, the pencil's kind of in the way. If you're holding it, like you want to not knock it off when you're holding it. So I still find that I'm like taking off and like putting it down sometimes, just to have that free side. But it's
it doesn't roll away as easily anymore.
Yeah, it's definitely an improvement from the last version of like how that all worked.
And they have like an onboarding screen now when you plug it in for the first time. Like on the original pencil, you plug in to the Lightning port and then it says pair, and then you press it and then you're on your own. Whereas this, they have like little intro screens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The biggest issue for drawing on the iPad for me still is that the pencil tip to the glass screen, it's still really slippery. Like you just can't have the same friction as like an ink pen or a lead pencil on paper. Like that is friction and you feel
like the scratchiness. Yeah
and on the iPad, like right now it feels pretty good, but the more I use it, it's a fingerprint magnet, and that like friction feel to it goes away super fast, and all of a sudden it's as slippery as it used to be. Like this is in 24 hours of usage, and it's just a little bit less comfortable to draw Apple Pencil on glass than it is to draw with a real instrument on paper. I like it though, like the convenience of having the iPad with me with, you know, infinite tools to use to create with, versus, you know, real world tools that I'm not traveling with and don't have. So that is a difference that I don't know if Apple will ever work out between having a really good tablet that isn't a dedicated, you know, drawing device to. But that was an issue for me before. It remains an issue, so it is what it is. The Smart Keyboard Folio, it's really easy to put on. Like it just clips to the back of the iPad with magnets, no adhesive or anything like that. I really like it as an upgrade from the old version. I don't use the Smart Keyboard a lot, but I like to have it as a stand for one, because I don't want to have a Smart Cover and a Smart Keyboard, so I just get the one. And then when I like am messaging or you know, if I occasionally like want to type up an article or something offline, you know, away from my Mac on the iPad, like the Smart Keyboard is easier to use. But I'm actually really good with typing on the glass keyboard too. But just as a comparison of the original Smart Keyboard to the Smart Keyboard Folio, it is, in my opinion, way better. The original version was like really floppy and folding it was tricky. You had to kind of learn it, and it was like doing origami to make the right triangle for it to stand up. And I see a lot of people like try and do it and everything falls over and it's not good. The new one, like the cover, it's like a book. Like it's like a sturdy, hard flap. And like that's the keyboard, that's the cover. No folding required. That means the top of it is flat without the ridge for the keyboard to fold back into. It's really plain. Like I was thinking this morning, I was dropping my kid off at daycare and my iPad was in the front seat face up with the keyboard cover. And it's like, that looks so generic. I don't think anyone would steal it yet. This is really plain.
Yeah. Don't test that theory.
Yeah. I'm not going to, but it's kind of a plus. And the fact that the back of it covers the iPad without putting an Apple logo on it, I like that too. And, because before Apple made the silicone case for the iPad back cover, and it was meant for portrait orientation, not landscape. So I could see them doing a goofy sideways Apple. Now the sideways Apple on the iPad itself gets covered up with the folio. So I like that. Moving it around and everything, it just feels way more sturdy. Like in the lap, it's easier to use. You don't have it bend inward and hit the space bar on accident. Really happy with this. If you like Smart Keyboard as a thing, I think Smart Keyboard Folio is just all around a better product.
Yeah, the only thing you kind of lose is when you fold it behind and you're holding it, then you like the keys face outwards now, so you can like press the keys to your fingers on the backside. Even though they don't actually activate, you can just feel them.
Yeah, that part is awkward. And before, like, you know, you've got these two angles, and I've got pictures of both angles on both iPads, 9.7-inch, from 2016 and then the 11 inch from now, and how it looks. And I mean, to me, that isn't a great advertising feature, because they're both like one angle is usable and one angle is like more steep, but not like a right angle. And it's just, the second angle, the one that's further back on the 11 inch Smart Keyboard Folio, is like, I'm not going to use that as much, I don't think. And before, you could do that by folding the keyboard back and then you still had keys facing out. you know, when you wanted to use it as like a, just a triangle, like a smart cover on its own. So yeah, that part of it, I don't think is like a much of an advancement, but just that, like opening it and closing it and like opening it and folding it back, like it's just way easier to use now. I think people will like it compared to the old version if you like the smart keyboard.
Yeah, and it's a keyboard case ultimately. It should prioritize getting the keyboard usage right versus anything else.
Yeah, and to me, I know a lot of people that like iPad like things like the Bridge keyboard and or just like generic Bluetooth keyboards, that, you know, keyboard cases and keyboards. To me, if I'm going to use the iPad, this is my keyboard because I like typing on it just fine. Like I like the material feel, I like the tactile keys. It's a good experience for me. I don't dislike it. And going from 9.7 inch to 11 inches, the keys are a little bit bigger too. So it makes it a little bit easier to use. The thing, and I'm not going to charge and pair a Bluetooth keyboard. I would just use the iPad keyboard on screen if I were to do that, but just because of the convenience. But like having it as a part of the cover is nice. And this just feels like way tidier and less messy and more like a book. Like you know, it's a folio, but it, like just because the front flap is so sturdy and you open it up and it doesn't like open and fold. It's much, I like it a lot better, much tidier. The one nice concern is that the material seems to like pick up dirt really easily and like stickiness, and like, so you gotta be really aware of what surface you're putting it on, and depending on like how you use it, the you know, what touches the surface could touch the iPad screen and like transfer dirt. So I've been like finding things to put under it instead of like the table or whatever surface it is. So that still exists, but overall, like, I've got one picture of the whole thing unfolded from both versions, and it's just, you know, obviously you can look at it and see that this is a much tidier, you know, product than it used to be. So
yeah.
Yep. And then kind of the last thing on my list here is the charger situation. So you get the new 18 watt charger, charging brick, and a USB-C charging cable. It's kind of a weird thing. Like the cable itself is very thin compared to Apple's USB-C to Lightning cable, for example. Like that feels kind of rigid and thick and just like less flimsy. So in comparison, this new cable that comes with the iPad feels kind of like Lightning earbuds, the ear pods that come in the iPhone box, how it's like big connector, thin cable, kind of feels flimsy. And I don't know why that is. Like, I guess it's because it's charging only on that data too, I think, but it just feels weird. And then the fact that the new 18 watt brick is its own thing and you can't pull off the duck head and like put the extension cord on it too, or like then, you know, then if like I'm limited by the length of this cable. So what I found is I already had the 29 watt USB-C charger and the USB-C to Lightning charger, which is like the way too pricey solution from Apple for fast charging your iPhone, and I've used that just to like top up my iPhone really fast. I just have it laying around. So I've traded the brick and the cable for the iPhone and iPad for charging. So now I'm using the 29 watt USB-C brick with the cable that the iPad comes with, because it's USB-C to USB-C. And then I'm using the 18 watt charger with the USB-C to Lightning cable for the iPhone. Huh. So it's still faster than 5 watts because it's 18 and you're getting, you know, fast charging that way. And then for the iPad, I'm going from 18 to 29 watts. And honestly, like, that's what it should be for the iPhone and the iPad in the box.
Yeah.
not 5 for the iPhone and then 18 for the iPad, which is an improvement over like 10 and 12, but probably out of necessity, not
yeah, because the new iPad Pros can draw up to 45 watts total if you get the big enough charger, apparently.
Nice.
Yeah.
So for anyone that like has both of those things, I recommend swapping them. And if you have the, you know the cord that used to come with the MacBook.
Yeah, the extension thingy.
I think you can buy those for like a stupidly high price of like $19 separately. But I've got like 10 laying around from old computers. Like because I used to have to replace MagSafe all the time when Cat would chew it up. But I had to get a new MagSafe charger, and then I'd have like extras of those cords. So now I can use that to make my iPad charger longer, and it's nice. But I think a lot of people like the Anker $26 30 watt charger and this USB-C. So that's, you know, not Apple prices, and you still get a faster version than what's in the box. And for now, you can't buy the 18-watt charger because, I guess, supply or whatever. Like, that was rumored to be happening, and then it turned out to be true. So,
and just jumping off the cable situation quickly, the last week when we were doing like the event impressions, we highlighted where they said the iPad can drive 5K displays, and I wasn't sure if that was real 5K, 5K at 60, upscale 4K, and it took a while, but we finally got clarity, and I got a stupidly long post to explain this stuff. But in short, the iPad can drive a 5K display at 60 Hz, but it doesn't use Thunderbolt. It uses the DisplayPort 1.2, or what, some weird new DisplayPort over USB-C, which displays which support that are approximately zero at the moment. So the LG Ultrafine the LG Ultrafine 5K cannot work with the iPad Pro. The LG Ultrafine 4K can work with the iPad Pro because that's a USB-C display, but you can't use the USB-C cable that comes with the iPad because that's charging only, so it's not high bandwidth enough. You could use the USB-C cable, that comes with the 4K display, and that will work. Or if you want to go into an Apple store and buy a compatible cable, you have to buy the Thunderbolt cable because Apple doesn't sell high bandwidth USB-C cables. You have to buy the Thunderbolt cable, and then the iPad will not use the Thunderbolt part, but it will use the DisplayPort part of the USB-C inside it. Simple.
Common sense, duh.
Yeah. And if you want to connect it HDMI, you can get dongle, USB-C dongles that will work, but some of the dongles will work and output Dolby Vision. Other dongles will output HDR10, and none of them will output Dolby Atmos. So it's, there's a big mess. And Apple even says that ones that support Dolby Vision are currently unavailable. They say it will support it when adapters become available. So it's complicated. And I wish Apple would stop like messing around with these like charge cables and just include a proper USB-C cable in the boxes with both the iPads and the Macs. Yeah. It's just kind of annoying that, oh, it only charges. It's like, okay,
great. It's always so nice when I buy an electronic device from another company besides Apple that comes with, like if you buy the Apple TV, you don't get the HDMI cable in the box. And you, if you buy a cheap one, you don't get support for Dolby Vision and Atmos. Like, you need to have a higher speed one. So then you've got to learn how HDMI cables work. Well, I had sent to me the Sonos Beam soundbar, and I was just amazed that it for consumers too, it comes with the HDMI cable in the box. It's just like, how can you pull that off? It's amazing. and with the iPad, the 5K situation is that the only 5K display that we kind of know of is the LG Ultrafine 5K display that's a Thunderbolt display, and that's how the bandwidth that gets across the Thunderbolt. And through this display port 1.2 spec for USB-C as the connector, there will be a display that's 5K that uses USB-C display port 1.2 coming. It's been announced from like some obscure brand, and it's ugly as all can be. Makes the LG ones look pretty. So like the iPad Pro can do it, but Apple doesn't make a display, and neither does LG, because they have USB-C 4K displays and Thunderbolt 3 5K displays. So you've got to wait for somebody else to make a 5K USB-C display.
Yeah, and in all the Apple marketing for the iPad Pro, they show the 4K LG.
Right. So the keynote, they said 5K. In practice today, you're only going to get 4K, even if you have a 5K LG display that Apple sells. So you've got to wait for a 5K display that uses DisplayPort 1.2 over USB-C.
Or 2.0. It's some weird version number.
You'll know it when you see it because it's 5K, but it's USB-C, not Thunderbolt. Even though the connector is the same, it doesn't have a lightning bolt on it. Which all of that is so fun, like so terribly confusing. But the fact that it ends with Thunderbolt, which isn't a thing. I mean, it's a spec, but not a thing. Is like, and you look for the lightning bolt, which is not a lightning cable.
I mean, it's really impressive that the iPad can do this at all. Like,
yeah.
But there are some asterisks that you need to be aware of.
Yeah, and by the way, put me down for a fan of USB-C as the iPad connector. And the fact that it's thinner than the iPhones, like, I would not mind if the iPhone in a year or two had USB-C as well, and we just transitioned away from Lightning. I suspect like that Lightning would stick around for like AirPods or at least the Siri remote on the Apple TV as like an accessory charger. but I would not mind if like the main things that I charge were either wireless or USB-C. So yeah, I'm down for it. A few things here that I've got in my notes that kind of weren't in my hands-on story from today. Like day one, you've got muscle memory of like reaching out for Touch ID. And it's not there. And so you've got to kind of rejigger your memory and like figure out how to use Face ID. And Face ID is pretty, I mean, it's nice because it works in any orientation. As we know, you do find that you cover it often from what I've experienced, and you get the friendly arrow and the warning on screen to, uncover, you know, Face ID.
They even have like new messages on the lock screen, like you're too far away, you need to look down. Like it's more, they need to kind of add some of those guides to the phone, I think, as well.
The looked down one is, I think that one's fine. The too far away one is just like kind of a disappointment because it's like my iPad is on my desk and I can read it and I've got really bad vision and my glasses don't help me a whole lot, but like reading is not easy for me just visually. And I can see my iPad. I can reach across and unlock it, but the Face ID is too far away for me to unlock it. And I've often, so far, like in the last day that I've been using it, I've seen that if I try again, I'm not too far away. So it's not perfect yet in that regard. It's just the difference of using an iPad and an iPhone, and facial recognition is different than the fingerprint stuff is. It's just like a new set of growing pains. I've also found that the gestures for navigation, I love them on the iPhone. They're so natural and I don't have any conflicts. On the iPad, it's a little weird still. Like I feel like they could just like hit reset and get this better. For example, like on the iPhone, you don't have the whole situation where you swipe up and you have the dock first.
Yeah.
You know, so that's one conflict. I've also seen that on the iPhone, it's like if you're on home screen 2 or 3 or 4, like if you have that many, and you swipe up, it's like clicking the home button and it takes you back to the first home screen.
Yep.
I've got a habit of that. Like even if I'm on the second home screen, like swipe up, go back to the first one, even though it's the same as like swipe left or right. On the iPad, it works for me sometimes, and sometimes it shows me the dock or like multitasking, and I've not quite figured out like why am I seeing the dock and not just going home. Like I think maybe it's like it's not supposed to work and you always see the dock if you go up a little bit, like swipe up a little bit. But I've found that I keep doing that. Like I'm on the second home screen, the third one, and I go swipe up because I want to know the first one and skip 2, for example. And I'm not sure that I can do it every single time. So that's a weird
one. Assuming it's the same algorithms as what the other iPads get, because obviously the other iPads get the same one finger swipes. They just don't have the indicator at the bottom. It's kind of based on how fast you're flicking. Like if you flick really quickly, it will act like you're quitting the app or you're pressing the button, you know, the virtual button that isn't there anymore. Whereas if you do it slightly more gently, then it starts off with the dock first.
Okay. And I've always been a fan of 4 or 5 fingers swipe up to go to multitasking or the home screen. Swipe like pinch in with your fingers to go to the home screen, or swipe up to go to multitasking. And for some reason, I'm doing a lot of pinch in and I'm seeing multitasking like the apps in a grid. I don't know if it's like just that I haven't used the iPad as much lately as I used to or what. But
no, this changed in iOS 12 as well.
Okay,
online.
It's driving me crazy.
you have to, if you crunch like with the 5 fingers, if you do that with more vigor, it will go straight home. If you do it gently, it's like it's kind of analogous to the iPhone, where if you slide up more slowly, it goes to the multitasking cards, and if you slide it quickly, it goes home. It's okay. That, but for the 5 finger gestures as well.
Okay, I didn't know that vigor was a variable here, but now I do. So I'll report back.
I think technically it's more like momentum or whatever. But if you do it aggressively, you'll go straight home. If you do it gently, you'll go into multitasking. Well,
I think last time I was running out of stamina, so I was just going. let's see what else I got. I think that's about it. It's like the biggest thing for me is like the way I use the iPad is I don't need to replace a Mac. So I don't have that as like any kind of a challenge or anything for me. It's like my Mac is my Mac, my iPad is my iPad, and my iPhone is my iPhone. Like I love the original introduction of like, you know, Steve Jobs is the iPad, and for it to deserve to exist, it needs to do a few things better than the iPhone or Mac. Like things that they can do, but then do them better. Whether it's like browsing the web or, you know, email or reading a book, like those are better on an iPad or can be better on an iPad than on the Mac or an iPhone. And like, that's what I like about the iPad. Like watching a video on YouTube or a FaceTime call, like those are definitely better on the iPad for me than on the iPhone, even with a XS Max. It's like, it's bigger, but not big. The iPad at any size is like better for that for me. And the fact that the Pro and, you know, now the 329 iPad even does the pencil stuff. It's like, you know, and it can be a sketchbook, you know, for me, for my interest in that. And I love that the ergonomics of using all these accessories is way better this time around. And the fact that like drawing on glass is so slippery and you don't have that friction is like the thing that just sticks out in my mind is like what I want this to do next is like solve that somehow. And I don't know if they can.
Maybe with some like haptic response. They could do some like force touch trackpad magic kind of thing to kind of emulate some of that maybe.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the main thing that like sticks out as me is like still an opportunity. But other than that, like, I mean, it's just a better version of everything the iPad could already do. Plus future proof for like iOS 13, 14, and 15 and new hardware. So I'm happy, you know, and like I said, it doesn't need to replace my Mac. If you get to be able to do things like windowing with multiple apps open without the constraints of, split view and slide over, then I think it'll be way better. Because like even on the Mac, I love mission control and I love windowed apps overlapping each other and different arrangements, but I don't like to do full screen with two apps side by side on the Mac, and different, you know, intervals. I don't love that at all. And even on the iPad, like I'll do it occasionally for multitasking stuff, but since Twitter lost the streaming API, it's less interesting to me to do multitasking, and it's just like I'm just kind of in one app, and so for that reason, like I'm pretty happy with having the 11 inch over the 12.9 inch, because 12.9 inch is a multitasking beast, and the 11 inch is, you know, more comfortable like in bed at night. So
yeah, especially as you said, you use it a lot in portrait.
Mm-hmm, yeah, exactly. So I'm really happy with it. I'll, you know, report back over the next few weeks and like see how my usage changes, but no part of me like regrets buying it or anything like that, or, you know, any major complaints. I think it's a great upgrade from the 2 years ago version. If you have last year's version, maybe there's too much overlap with like performance and everything, but it's a nice change, especially the accessories. So
yeah,
I dig it. Yep.
Yeah, just it definitely very good job from Apple Incorporated.
9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Ops Genie, now from Atlassian. Downtime is awful. You've lived through it, I've lived through it, and it's no fun. It doesn't matter if it's at home or at work or wherever you experience downtime. When a system you rely on goes down, it immediately throws a wrench in every part of your life. When it's worse is when you're the one responsible for fixing it, and you don't have a plan to manage your way through it. That's what Ops Genie is for. Ops Genie gives your team the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues. Are any bad issues ever planned for? I think we all know how that goes. Ops Genie helps you notify the right people through a smart combination of scheduling and escalation paths that take into account things like time zones, vacations, and holidays. Obviously, you want the right person notified immediately, but if that person's not available, you want the next person notified without having to wait, only to realize that the first call person isn't actually on call. This is where Ops Genie's smart magic comes into play. It knows because you've told it previously, back when times were calmer and you could think through it all. Ops Genie keeps track of all that for you, and when problems inevitably occur, Ops Genie is there to help. Also, now that Ops Genie is part of Atlassian, it opens to all kinds of integrations with things like Jira, Amazon CloudWatch, Datadog, New Relic, and more. That's what Atlassian is all about. They integrate well with their own solutions, but they also integrate with other popular solutions too. Check it out, opsgenie.com, to sign up for a free company account for up to 5 users. No credit card required, no time restrictions. This is a fully free account for you to actually use, not just try. That's opsgenie.com. Never miss a critical alert again with Ops Genie. Our thanks to Ops Genie by Atlassian for sponsoring the show. Now, the MacBook Air and Mac Mini, the reviews for those are out since our last episode, and the hardware is out. And, I mean, we kind of went over last week what we thought about both after, you know, as part of the event episode. Anything to add since then?
Any changes? I think the reviews came out kind of expected. People, it was kind of funny because obviously the same people that reviewed the MacBook Air were also reviewing the iPad Pro, and then you'd have a lot of the tech reviews would do like iPad Pro can't replace your laptop, blah blah blah. This sucks. We need more software updates. We need better OS. And then you'd have the Air, which is they'd literally been reviewing that alongside the iPad Pro. They just couldn't talk about it until the day after. And it was in most cases the Airs they had were cheaper than the iPad Pros they were reviewing. So it's like in many ways Apple kind of stacked the deck against them. But and the Air reviews were like, yeah, it's fine. The processor's I think better than most people expected. It's not as fast as some stuff, but it's pretty good, especially considering it's the lower wattage class. And I think it's generally just like a plain sailing update, really. Like,
yeah,
they aren't pushing the boat out with it, with it, right? There's nothing like cutting edge on it. It's just a perfectly fine update for an entry level laptop, except it's not quite entry level because it's $1,200. Blah 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 blah. That's yeah. And the Mac Mini's pretty powerful. And if you don't like the idea of all-in-ones, definitely a good thing to consider. But I think that the vast, vast majority of people in the world should buy your iMacs instead because they're just so much nicer as an overall package.
Yeah, unless you've had a mouse, keyboard, and display that you love already. Then.
Or you're doing like the weird like rack-mounting server, you know, build system stuff. Like,
yeah. I was surprised by how at least the press reviews took the MacBook Air as the MacBook Air legacy version, like the replacement of it, like that this is the new one, because it's, you know, I had this question in my mind of like what defines a MacBook Air. Is it the wedge shape and, you know, the tapered edges, or is it that plus the ports, you know, MagSafe, USB-A, Thunderbolt 3 headphone jack, and it's like SD card slot. It's like so much, you know, that didn't seem to be a big issue. I mean, and I guess it's that we now know that future MacBooks all make those changes, but I would have expected more people to be that love the MacBook Air to be disappointed by the port options. I mean, because one charger is your power, or one port is your charging, you know, power solution, and the other one is like what's left. So it's but people seem to seem to accept it. So and I'm not going to make too much of a fuss about it because, like, you know, it's I don't have to buy it. So.
Yeah, it's not on our radar as much at the moment, at least.
Yeah, and it's nice that Apple's got you know, and the spirit of the MacBook Air continues. So, and the same for the Mac Mini. One more thing, reversing a little bit on iPad is we had one listener named Tim who emailed you know, basically, you know, in response to our discussion on the smart connector change and how it goes from the edge of the iPads to the back center of the bottom, and there weren't very many accessories before for the old style smart connector. It was the smart keyboards from Apple, some Logitech keyboard cases, and this one Logitech base. And our listener Tim uses two of the bases with iPads side by side, and the idea there is that it's slower to charge over that, you know, through little pens, because it's not as fast as like Lightning. I guess there's just fewer pens, etc. And you got to plug in Lightning to the back of the base to power that. But it's just really convenient to just like, drop it there and make it magnetically attaches, and it's a stand for upright viewing and landscape orientation. And it's like that is lost now with the new iPad Pro, and that's something that like I'm a big fan of. I've got my old one on that stand right now still, and I tried like playing with the alignment, and I couldn't make it power the new one. And the same with the keyboard, I couldn't make it like make a connection, even if you try and do it.
Apple should make one just like the equivalent of like a Lightning dock for a phone. It's just like the iPad base or whatever you want to call it.
But I was happy to see that, like, I know one of our colleagues, Chance Miller at NFM Mac, is also a fan of that product, and it's originally priced at like $100, and I think they dropped it to like 80 and sometimes even less than that, but which is still like kind of expensive for what it is. But it's once you buy it and you just own it, it's really nice to have. And seeing this picture from listener Tim with like two side by side, and I think he's got the keyboard where you can switch between both iPads, it's a pretty cool setup. And I'm happy to know that you know, more people use that as solution. And I really wouldn't mind if it came back from Apple, from Logitech, Belkin, whoever, but using that smart connector. And now the new location, maybe it could be in Portrait. I wouldn't mind that. Might be okay. Kind of like the original iPad dock with the keyboard on it. Yeah, but the other thing is the I listen to a lot of podcasts, and tech podcasts especially, and I've heard a lot of people complain about the lack of an Apple display, and so I just wanted to flag again for anyone who doesn't know that Apple's definitely making a new Mac Pro in 2019. Like they say that is the year of Mac Pro. It might be in December, but it's going to be in 2019, the Mac Pro, unless it gets delayed. And they've also said that they're working on a new Pro display. Like it's not a maybe, it isn't a rumor. It's like Apple said they're going to make a Pro display. That's what they said. We assume it's going to only work on the Mac Pro. You know, for some reason, like it might not just be like Apple's version of the LG 5K with Thunderbolt 3.
Yeah, because every time they mention it, they say they always use these adjectives like high-end pro display. Like, I think they're setting it up to be something that you can't just plug in any old Mac that's existed for the last few years to it, or maybe you can, but it doesn't go at full resolution. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's gonna be first and foremost designed to go straight with the new Mac Pro.
Yeah,
is how I read it.
So I just want to say, like, a reminder that that is a known thing and not a rumor, and it's not a maybe. It's definitely going to happen, and we know Mac Pro 2019, and so we can assume that this is the display that goes with Mac Pro, and that the display will probably be 2019 as well. And I don't think it's safe to assume that it will work with the iMac Pro or iMac or the new Mac Mini in any configuration. Like maybe it will, like you said, in some limited way. But Apple could always go like 8K and you know have some high speed ports that only work on the Mac Pro in that way.
Yeah, like an 8K ProMotion thing, and it requires this special port with a Mac Pro, like something.
Yeah.
Something fishy like that. They definitely haven't promised it will be as universal as a standard display. So
yeah.
Let's put it like that way.
Yeah, and it'll be expensive.
Oh yeah, don't worry about that. It'll be expensive.
Yeah. But I think Apple should make a range of displays. they've never really done that, have they? Like in recent years, where they've had the Cinema display and they've had the Thunderbolt display, and then they had no display, and relied on LG, which had a 4K and a 5K. 21.5 inch and 27 inch, which is like the screen from the IMAX, but in an ugly casing.
Back in like 2005, they used to do like 24 inch and 27 inch cinema displays, but then the Thunderbolt display was only ever 27.
Okay, and so in that regard, like it would be neat if they had displays that were, you know, friendly with the MacBook, 12 inch MacBook. And displays that were friendly with the Mac Pro, like different
and iPad
models, and iPad, because if it's friendly with the MacBook, it's going to be friendly with the iPad.
Yeah,
because they're in the same league there. So, yeah, displays.
They definitely need to have the Apple Store stock a display that couldn't work with the iPad Pro at 5K. Like, I'm sure they're trying to source one to sell, but doesn't exist today.
Do you recall what the brand was of the one that you found? It was like
Planards, like it was a brand I've never heard before and clearly not memorable because it's
yeah.
And I couldn't find if it actually come out or not. Yeah, it's very in the weeds.
Yeah. Other thing is that since you know we've not really had a chance to discuss the iPhone XR since it launched. We know a lot about the XR, but we don't own them. But you have family with the iPhone XR, and I've been to a Best Buy that had a slot for one that was empty and then had a white 10R on a giant security system so I could kind of use it, but I've not seen the colors yet. But what about you?
Yeah. So my dad has the black one.
Creative.
And
okay.
Yeah. And it looks better than Space Gray 10. It's not as dramatic as like the jet black iPhone, the iPhone 7 or the matte iPhone 7, but it's still better. And then my brother has the blue one. Okay. And I was surprised at the hue of the blue. In person, it's more pale than I expected by looking at the website photos. Like, and I'm pretty sure if you use certain lighting, it would look identical to the website photos. But in like my household lighting, it's more baby blue than it is like bolder. Like, it's not as. I would prefer the 5C blue.
You know what's really nice in blue from Apple? The iPod Touch. They make a really nice blue iPod Touch.
Yeah, it is not like that color.
Yeah.
it is paler than that.
Yeah.
And then the 10R bezels are bigger for sure than the 10Ss, but they're not. They look better in person. it's a very weird like translation of it, seeing the thing on photos on the internet and seeing it in real life. Like, I think that phone is fantastic for what it offers, and I've been recommending that one left and right to people that want to change phones. Like, it has the best battery life of any of the models, and it has LCD screen that in many ways, I mean, everyone keeps, the funny thing was when the 10R reviews originally came out, everyone said the display is not as good as the 10S, but then when the iPad Pro comes out with the same liquid retina panel, everyone says the iPad Pro display is fantastic. Like, best, I think there's just kind of there was some kind of like inbuilt bias, I think, against it. Oh, it's not OLED, blah blah blah. It's absolutely fine. It's very, very pretty. The bezels are definitely bigger, but they're not ridiculous in any way. They look fine. If you Even side by side with mine, I was like, you know, if Apple had come out with that last year, I'd have probably just accepted it and never even thought twice about it. Like, it just is such a good phone, and I would happily, and I have been recommending it to loads of people over the more expensive ones. Like, the $250 difference is just not worth it for so many, many people.
The I would still go 10S or 10S Max.
Well, so would I, but like,
yeah, but for like
general market is...
Yeah,
10R is like a great sell.
For my very brief hands-on with a white iPhone XR and a Best Buy with a giant security device around the back of it, the one observation that I had was that the camera UI on the all-screen phone, so like it isn't as much of a problem on the phones with bezels because there's not so much black, but the camera UI on the all-screen phones has a lot of like empty, wasted space. And if you're taking a photo and like the screen's turned up to be pretty bright so that you can see like pretty good representation of like what you're capturing, that black UI is just like drowning the UI. And that's the only time when I felt like, man, this is an LCD screen. Like, I can, it looks blue the way that the black is like so bright, and you can see, you know, the notch and the borders and everything. Like, it's very clear that that's not ideal. And part of that is that the camera UI is kind of lazy.
because they match the viewfinder to the end photo, so that's what, like 3x2. But now since iPhone X, they've been doing these 18x9 phones.
Yeah.
So they just keep adding more and more border around the 3x2 viewfinder, and it's just even worse on as the phones get bigger, like on the 10R or the 10S Max. It's just even more black space. And the camera app's definitely one where they could make better use and put different controls in different places and maybe use the notch ears to put information, or even just like a little thumbnail strip at the bottom of the screen of the photos you just took. Like, they have that one thumbnail, but they could have like a whole strip down there now. Like, there's definitely, the camera app needs some updates.
Yeah, the third-party camera app, Halide, it does a much better job of using the whole screen of the interface to, you know, put controls and things there. But that is the only thing I had to complain about. It's just like, oh, the camera, that's really blown out because of how black the UI is versus everywhere else on iOS where it's primarily like white space if it's going to be blank space. So, but I don't have anyone. Like, you've got two people in your film that have them. I don't have anyone in mind. So we're older iPhones or iPhone X and XS's. I don't know. I will say, like, I don't regret upgrading to the XS Max. But like next year when I upgrade, I can totally see myself going back down to the smaller size.
Oh, you're going back down?
Well, yeah, going back down to the smaller size. It's like there's something premium about like being a little bit more portable. And then once you have like a decent iPad, it's like, you know, they're still way different. And there are times, like, I was watching the election results come in on Tuesday night, and just like watching like a news feed on YouTube. It was nice to have. It was like, I noticed that my screen's bigger on my phone. Like, I had it was like a bedside TV screen kind of. And it's like, that's bigger than, you know, what I'm used to watching video on from a phone. But in so many other situations, just like, you know, things are just further apart. I'm happy with it.
They need to let the Max phones do picture-in-picture like the iPads can.
Picture-in-picture and, like, just it doesn't feel like it takes advantage enough of the screen. Like, I don't know if it's limited by the resolution or like what it is, but like,
well, so much of iOS is just born out of it was made in eras of smaller screens, right? Like, it's still predominantly 4.7 inch kind of design around, like, a lot of the apps are 4.7 inch based, and then slightly more now the 5.8 inch size of the iPhone 10, but definitely not like the maxes or the pluses. Like, they're just bigger, right? And then they stretch it out in 99% of cases.
Yeah, that's why I think when I originally had it, I was like, you know, this thing could be bigger because, like, I can't one hand it. I'm getting pretty good at it, you know, shuffling it around my hand and, like, you know, navigating. But, like, it's still big enough that it takes intention to do that. And it doesn't feel like it shows that much more stuff. Like, it's a combination of, like, things are bigger and it can show more stuff. But it's like, I wish I could do more, like, for the screen difference. 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. It's no secret that hiring the right talent for your company is hard. It can feel like a full-time job all on its own, but LinkedIn can take the guesswork out of hiring. That's because LinkedIn is more than the world's largest professional network. It's also a better way to find great talent. The way it works now is you post a job to a jobs board and hope you find the right person for your job. But if you think about it, how often do you check job boards? For most people, it's a pretty occasional thing, but there is a place where people go daily to grow professionally and explore job opportunities. In fact, 70% of the U.S. workforce is already there. It's LinkedIn. You already know LinkedIn as the world's largest professional network. And here's the thing. It's also a better way to find great talent. Just ask any of the hundreds of thousands of businesses who have posted on LinkedIn Jobs over the past year. And because LinkedIn considers skills, experiences, location, and more to match and promote your job to potential candidates, businesses are rating LinkedIn Jobs 40% higher than jobs boards at delivering quality candidates. 22 million professionals view and apply to jobs on LinkedIn every week in every industry, even yours and mine. If you're not using LinkedIn for your hiring needs, there's no better time to start than now. Just go to linkedin.com/happyhour and get a $50 credit toward your first job post. That's linkedin.com/happyhour for your $50 credit today. Terms and conditions apply. Our thanks to LinkedIn Jobs for sponsoring 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour. We do have some changes coming in future iOS and watchOS updates. So these are point updates that we normally think are very boring based on their version number, but they've actually got some pretty interesting features. So this is iOS 12.1.1 beta and watchOS 5.1.2 beta.
Which would normally just signify bug fixes, but these happen to just randomly have quite a few nice little features in them.
So what's all included here?
Okay, so we've got the FaceTime changes. Thank the Lord. They have put the flip camera button back on the main screen of using FaceTime. So you don't have to dive into the submenu and then your preview thumbnail gets hidden while you flip the camera around. It's right there on the main screen. The card at the bottom now has four buttons and it has effects. It has the flip camera and then it has, what am I blanking on what it has? The mute button and then it has end call. And then because there used to be a more button, that is now only accessible by swiping up, which brings up the full screen card. But critically, you can flip the camera now without having to dive into the submenu, which is fantastic. They've also brought back live photos into FaceTime, which is one of the things I've been harking on about since throughout the 12.0 cycle. No idea why they had to ditch it in 12, but it is back in 12.1.1. You can just click the little shutter button and it takes a live photo of the other recipient, and it only works on one-to-one calls. It doesn't work on group calls.
Have you used Group FaceTime very much lately, like since it's launched?
I've used it a couple of times.
Yeah. The challenge for me has been telling family to update. Like, I say, hey, you'll get new emoji, and they kind of care more. But you can see, like, when you go to do a FaceTime call, you can type in their name, and it'll highlight in a color if they can do a group call, like if you can add more than one person, like I think. It's kind of like iMessage. Like, it's neat about that. But just, like, getting family to update has been a little bit of a challenge. It's like, It'll work itself out in time, but like that.
Yeah, they'll get there eventually.
Yeah, that's one thing. And the other thing I found is it's a little bit of a hiccup is that you know how when you on a regular FaceTime call one on one, it's like you get the full screen video of the other person.
Yeah,
and yourself. Once you go group, you're in a square, so that it can fit more. You know, float around. But like three calls, everyone's a square. And if the third person leaves, you don't go back to it. Like, even though you're just one-on-one, they can return, and they have, like, the silent notification on their lock screen, so they can just, like, tap it, and then they're back in.
Yeah.
But you stay square for the, like, remainder until you hang up and call back again. And I feel like that should revert back to, like, maybe it's just it can't, but it should go back to, like, the full screen video of, like, two people.
Yeah, like, because at the moment, you go from, like, a one-to-one session to a group session, but you can't go back from a group session to a one-to-one session.
Yeah, it just shows they're an inactive face down on the bot, like inactive contact card on the bottom.
Yeah, that is a bit awkward. But I don't. That tends not to happen very much, right? Like if you're having a group call when it's over, generally everyone leaves at the same time. But yeah, it's kind of silly that you can't just go back because even if there's only the group FaceTime's good, but if there's only three people on the call, for instance, then. It should be added. The boxes are a bit inefficient because they have like borders around them stuff. Like they could just make them bigger, and then you'd get most of the benefit back. Like and just have the rail in a very small thing. Like
I also don't think you like kick someone off. Like once you invite them in, I think they're in. We'll see. Like hang up and call back and make a new group. But it's kind of like 1.0 stuff there.
But yeah, group FaceTime pretty good for out the gate. Like it's definitely not buggy and it works and the call quality stays strong. So. I'm happy with it, and flip camera has been like my summer thing like for so long, and it's like, have they fixed flip camera? No. 12.1.1, holy moly, they fixed the flip camera out of absolutely nowhere, but I will take it and run with it.
So still in beta, but coming.
Yeah.
I presume.
Soon, probably by the end of the year. These updates probably happen in the year. And then they have, on iPhone XR, they let you long press on notifications to expand them, which is a 3D touch operation on XS and 10, but all phones past the 6S. But on iPad, they always let you long press to see the notification content. But for some reason, when the XR first came out, they didn't let you do this. So now they've updated it, so you can long press, and it will give you a little haptic feedback, and then it expands. So a nice little gimme for the XR people, and it was kind of stupid. It wasn't done in the first place. And then on the watch, they have responded in spades to the complaints that there were not first-party complications for the Infograph phase, and so now there are 8 total new complications. There's news, maps, mail, home, phone, remote, and Find My Friends that can all be added to the Infograph faces, and most of them are just like simple icon launchers. News can put the headline in the subdial, or on Infograph module it can go in that middle complication. And then, like, messages will badge itself with the number of unread messages, which is pretty nice.
Yeah, so not like a red dot badge, but a number within the icon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm actually using that one now on my Infograph modular phase, finally. So because I'd still had the double weather complication, just because I was never quite sure what to put in the last circular one. But now I've got the messages one, and I'm very, very happy with it.
I'm also
It's kind of stupid they couldn't do this at launch. Like, they got so much flack when they came out for, like, none of the Apple apps actually support the new face. And then a month later, they suddenly have all 8 ready to go. It's like, okay, but there you go. I'm happy that they're there.
Yeah, the last big opportunity seems to be to do more with the large middle one on Infograph Modular, because like not all of them are there. And it's like if it's an app launcher, it probably isn't going to have anything there. And like one of my other the apps I use a lot is the Nike Run Club app, and they also like released an update for everybody this week that has Infograph and Infograph Modular complications. And for the circles, it's a launcher. For the subdial top one, it's a launcher, and it has text for around the dial. It's like, are you running or are we running today? And your last run summarize. And in the corner, they have the month and your total distance for the month ran. But they have nothing for the Infograph modular big center complication, which could like they have a pretty good one I think on modular regular. So like they can do it. And then none of these Apple ones, except for like, what is it? It's news. And that's it. Have the
Yep, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Part of me thinks that like the ones that are just launchers, it was intentional not to include. Like they're like, if we can't do anything special, then just, you know, use the dock or the app launcher grid. But clearly they've listened. And once this beta is released, then those two watch faces will be, I guess, kind of at, probably at parity with the other watch faces now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah. I mean, it would be nice if, like, you could put the home complication on, like, the corner and then actually have text of, like, two lights on or something, or messages. If you put it in the center middle on Infograph module, it could, like, actually say the incoming message in the in the lines of text and the and the person who sent it. There's definitely more they could do, but even just having the launcher icons is really important, because so many people, like my dad, he just uses watch faces as the app launchers. Like he has like 10 watch faces, and he just has if one of the complications is not an app, he'll never open the app. If he wants to go to messages, he'll swipe between his watch faces till he finds the face that has the messages complication on it, and then tap that. So having the launchers is obviously way better than having nothing at all, even if they could, you know, theoretically be a bit more dynamic maybe down the road.
Yeah, I totally get it, because I mean I use two app launchers as complications. I use the workout complication and the Nike Rent Club complication in the circle slots on Infograph Modular, and those are just launchers. That's all they do. But it's, you know, it makes my watch feel like this is what its function is. It's to like track workouts, you know, and if it's for messaging, then it's the same thing. So I get it.
And then on Control Center now, there's a toggle for walkie-talkie, so you can toggle your availability to receive walkie-talkie chats from Control Center, and they just added it as an extra button at the bottom.
And you can
now, this is nice if you like toggling walkie-talkie a lot. When I first saw this, I was like, oh, so this is their new replacement for the flashing yellow indicator on the watch face in the top center. But no, that's still there. This is just a different way of toggling the availability without having to dive into the app itself. I think now that you can just swipe up and always see if you're available for walkie-talkie or not, you should be able to turn off the flashing on the watch face. Like, it just, that is like the thing that makes me always leave it off. It's just so annoying when every time you raise your wrist, you see like the flash of the little yellow radio symbol.
Yeah, me too. And you can turn off the red dot for alerts, which I go back and forth on this, but right now I have it off because I kind of always have an alert there. Like, even if I've seen it, then there's like something else, you know, it's always something there. You can't turn off the ones for like now playing, and which is annoying on its own, because like if it's playing from your phone or a HomePod or Apple TV, then you're probably gonna have a dot on your watch too. And you've got it for walkie-talkie. It's like that. The walkie-talkie thing is like, A, you got to have someone to walkie-talkie with. B, you've got to be okay with like getting a live message in the moment. So it's got to be the right situation. But then see, you've got that yellow flashing indicator. That's just like every single wrist raise. There it is. And for it to be permanent, it's like, I guess it isn't how Apple wants you to use walkie-talkie, but I can see people just like always having it on, like that being okay, maybe. And
yeah.
That rules that out for me, at least, if you, because of the indicator.
Yeah, same here. If they let you turn the red dot off, they should let you turn all of them off.
Yeah, the new tile in Control Center, though, I think it's cute. Like, it's a cute little icon. Tap it, turns yellow. It's like the filled in color, which is a new color for Control Center. They've got like blue, different blues and green and solid. So like for different buttons, but that one's a new one. And with the edit button, you can move it around. On my watch, I now have an even number of those tiles, because once they added the edit button, they used to go full width on a tile if it was on its own row. And with the edit button, they said, we're going to add an edit button, but we're going to have empty slots if you don't have an even number of icons there. And if you have LTE, you have an uneven number. So now I have an even number, which is nice, but you have an empty slot, right?
Yeah, so I've gone for it because the different one is the cellular one. That's the one that the Wi-Fi ones don't get. So I went from an even number to now plus the walkie-talkie one. I'm now suffering from the empty slot. And although you can rearrange the items in Control Center, you cannot delete any of them. So
right.
You just always have this gap.
So that walkie-talkie app is all the more pesky to you now.
Yeah, I was gonna happy with the trade-off if it meant that it didn't flash yellow on the watch face, but when I saw that it still did, that was like, great, now you just made my control center more annoying.
Yeah. It made a little bit more sense when it was like persistent because you could tap it, and now you gotta like erase to tap it. It's just hard. They should just give you something for that.
Yeah. One thing I'm happy about is the Messages app no longer shows you the Apple Pay Cash button if your country does not have Apple Pay Cash, which is a change they made in WatchOS 5, where in, for instance, the UK, where we don't have Apple Pay Cash, and we probably won't for years, before, it would just not show it. On WatchOS 5, it would always show it, but it'd be grayed out. And I actually found a radar about this, and they said this was intended behavior. So I was very upset, because then there was basically just a logo permanently on my screen that I could never use. Well, they clearly had a change of heart, because in 5.1.2, the Apple Pay Cash button disappears, and you just get a grid of the four actions you can actually use, which is very nice to see.
It's like this weirdly version number point update is all these little fixes, you know, based on kind of feedback. So it's going to be nice when it comes out, whenever that is. The ECG app is still kind of missing in action, right? Like, it's not in any of these betas. It'd only be in the US, we presume, sometime this month. At the earnings call a week ago, I think Tim Cook said later this year, which is, you know, not a slowdown from what they originally said. We just don't know if it's going to be
just a repeat of what they originally said.
Yeah, just repeat. So that's weird. Also at the earnings, I think we'll probably discuss this more next quarter when it has an effect. But Apple, in addition to their earnings, which you can like go and look up if you're curious about what the numbers were, but they announced that they're no longer going to and break out how many iPhones were sold, how many Macs were sold, and how many iPads were sold like they've done before. And the last time they kind of did this was with iPod Touch. They stopped giving iPod Touch numbers when they stopped selling iPod Touch. It's just like... It's way more complicated now in this situation because they're obviously like not selling iPhones, iPads, and Macs, but they're no longer going to give the numbers out every quarter.
Yeah, they give total revenue, but they don't give unit sales. And they renamed the other products category to home, wearables, and... It's some weird name that they've changed the other products to, but that's the category that holds like the HomePod and the Apple Watch and stuff. And obviously, ever since the Apple Watch came out, they never gave that. They never disclosed unit sales. They always only did the revenue, and now they're applying that to all of their lines.
I think it's home wearables and accessories, which is where the iPod Touch fits into.
With the iPod Touch in it, yeah, I guess that lives at home. But I don't like this, like. I like knowing the actual numbers because I guess we're just nosy, but they're not. And they're probably doing it because they know that they're not going to be very impressive for a while. Like, I don't think iPhone sales are going to fall off a cliff and start like plummeting. It would just be middling, flat, 0% growth, 1% like, here, 2% here.
You can sell fewer, pricier phones and have a healthy business, and like, and people, investors will be upset that you've sold fewer phones. Like, even if you're making the revenue goals. Fewer units year over year is concerning.
Yeah, and
investors, and they're hiding that.
And Apple was the only company. Yeah, and Apple was the only like smartphone company that still did this, that released unit sales numbers that officially Samsung and all the rest, they only ever reported revenue. This is definitely one way that Apple has successfully doubled down on secrecy, because now they just don't tell you the numbers at all.
Yeah, the thing I think where this might backfire a little bit is like we've already seen reports of iPhone XR isn't selling as well as Apple thought, so the factory is pulling back production. It's like there were always reports like that for launches, same with iPhone X, but then Apple would put out their results and people would be like, this couldn't be true then because they sold a lot of iPhones, except now they won't have the part where Apple says they sold a lot of iPhones like with any number. They used to announce the weekend iPhone sale, so pre-order in like the first few days of like selling in stores, I guess, and it was always like a record-breaking number. And then they eventually said, we were not going to release numbers ahead of time. They said ahead of time they're not going to release numbers. And then the reason was that they couldn't make as many as they would sell more if they could make more. It would be limited by production, and so the number had no meaning anyway. And it's like slowly they're being – as those numbers become less impressive – I mean, they're impressive but not as the year-over-year compare,
yeah,
then Apple's, you know, doing what they have a right to do, which is not sharing them anymore.
And it can work in both ways, right? There could be quarters where investors estimate that they've actually sold less than they have, and then it could be, in reality, that they could have sold more phones, but they don't tell you, so you wouldn't know. And then that also balances out with the quarters where the sales were less stellar, and maybe if they'd been public, investors would have freaked out and sold the stock, and they've held on to it. But it's certainly not like a 100% net win, and obviously the stocks took a bit of a battering just in them announcing that, because investors don't like uncertainty, so the stocks fallen a bit. And so it's not like a 100% like them. It's a hard choice, and it's definitely not motivated by like a short-term thing. This is a long-term decision that they'll stick with. And I'm sure even things like, as the iPad becomes more capable, it starts encroaching on more Mac sales. So maybe Mac sales fall, and then what actually counts as a Mac versus an iPad? Like, a lot of that will all spill over, and it just gets very complicated. So I think they took the decision, hey, we're ending the year with a solid product line, and probably it's the start of the new fiscal year, so we've reevaluated, and nobody got too upset that we never told them watch numbers, and we're the only people still reporting phone numbers, so now we can stop doing that, and we'll probably dull down the headlines of Apple phone sales slowing or whatever, because you can always quote all these like analyst reports of bad sales, but nothing ever would like reach headlines as like Apple's official numbers. And if they can forecast there are going to be some quarters which are not as good as others, that definitely dulls out the press interest in it. Like, you can't make a good headline when you're saying according to analysts versus Apple reports iPhone sales down year over year. And you know, it's just not a very nice headline for them to have in the press. Like, it just gives a bad impression to normal people who, you know, don't follow this religiously, but they see that and they're like, oh, now the, you know, Apple's doomed. Or I think it just makes it easier for them to just say less and move on.
yeah. So in 3 months we'll see how it goes. I mean, I think we do know that Apple would like to, like, they have to do these quarterly reports, but they would like to do fewer of even those, because they don't see the every 3 months update as a sign of the company's health. And I think the president has shown interest in pulling back that requirement for the, you know, companies like Apple's interest. And that's one thing where like Tim Cook, Apple, and the president agree. And that isn't a change that's been made yet, but I could see that happening. And if that requirement, like if they're no longer required to give these quarterly reports, like if they're like semi-annually, I could see Apple being like totally into that too. And then we'd have like semi-annual updates and not quarterly updates. Whatever.
And of course, services are an increasing part of their business. So
yeah,
that again dominates more than, oh, we sold 1 million more phones than we did last year, for instance.
Yep. All right. Last thing I want to mention this week is putting an end to the saga of what Mac I want to buy. And I sold my 12-inch MacBook Pro. Got $800 for it, $810, which was like my goal was $800. This is with eBay, and I was really happy with that. It's shipped and gone. And after the event, I didn't tell you this, Maya, but after the event last week, with no new iMac announced and no new iMac on the website, and the rumors not being like it's going to be a crazy update,
yeah,
I priced out a Mac Mini and did the specs of the Mac Mini, the 2018 Mac Mini, of like what I wanted, and it was like 16 gigabytes of RAM, one terabyte SSD to match my MacBook Pro that I had. I think that's a good fit for me. Display, I want a 27-inch display, you know, the 5K Thunderbolt display again, the mouse and keyboard. And I was like, I was getting into the $4,000 range for the whole thing. And I was like, you know what? I know I can get an iMac for less or a refurbished iMac Pro for about
the same. Oh, here we go.
And I actually ended up getting the refurbished iMac Pro for less than what I was specing out the Mac Mini with actually like less specs. So because it's refurbished, it's not the full price, but it's still, you know, under warranty, and I can buy AppleCare for it. I think I will. But
so yeah, that's what you're using right now?
Yeah, I've had it for about a week now. And the biggest change, it could be, you know, any iMac, of course, or like an external display, but like going from 12 inches to 27 inches, it's easier to use. And I, you know, I sold my, I thought about keeping the MacBook around for like the few times a year that I travel for work. But I think I would just be way too tempted to keep using the MacBook for like convenience around the house working too. And I've done this before, but I don't have a desktop, and I'm more productive on a desktop than a notebook. So I sold it. And you know, I made enough from the MacBook to like cover the price of the iPad itself. You know, I feel good about it. And, in terms of the specs, like, I mean, part of it was like the color of the iMac Pros. Like it's newer looking than the silver ones, cause they look so dated to me. And this thing just looks like, I love the way, I like the way it looks. I don't love it, but I like the way it looks on the space gray color. The big bezels are less, terrible. But I mean, also I looked at the price difference from iMac with similar specs to iMac Pro. It's not crazy different when you're looking at the refurbished price.
Yeah.
And especially when I was like really considering the Mac Mini with peripherals, and it would cost more. mean, the savings really is because when you go to refurbish, you like save $750 from the base model price.
Yeah.
And like spec wise, I mean, if you look at the performance charts, I think you need to go up to the 10 core to really get some benefits there. So it's not in like a crazy leagues of like performance, of course. And that's what our discussion was like, was the iMac Pro more than what I needed? And looking at all the specs, it's like 10 core is what would be more than what I needed, but 8 core is not insane.
Okay. And, so you didn't go too wild.
Yeah. It's not insane. And it's enough RAM that I can handle loads of tabs in Safari and photos and Pixelmator and, you know, editing podcasts is way more enjoyable. I had to buy the trackpad additionally because I have to have a trackpad for Logic. Like zooming in and out is just, and panning around is like required. But I prefer the mouse every other time I'm using the computer. But yeah, I didn't go crazy, and it's nice. And I've got the port situation is just so – I love the port situation. You know, you've got 4 USB-C Thunderbolt 3 ports and 4 USB 3.0 USB-A ports, so I can plug in all my things without compromise. It's really nice. You know, you get the Ethernet port. That would be $100 more on the Mac Mini that I can't take advantage of, but it's there. Yeah, it's really nice. I'm happy with it.
Well, we can check another Mac off your owned list.
Yep. No, I
will preempt the Happy Hour episode next year at some point when they release bezel-less iMacs, and then you end up buying one of those instead.
You know.
Yes.
I don't know.
That is going to happen. You'll sell this one on, and then you'll be like, and now I've got a nice looking iMac that is the same performance profile but looks a lot prettier.
Yeah, well, then we'll see. But
I guarantee it's going to happen.
At any rate, I am happy. I've been happy. It's a real. I mean, it's a difference. You know, go from a notebook to a desktop and the extremes. But I've gotten adjusted to everything. So
I mean, I said it right when we were in the Mac section earlier. I said the Mac Mini is very niche, and most people should buy all in ones. And you did it.
Yeah, that's what it was. I don't already have a mouse, keyboard, and the display that I want. And by spec, you know, putting in enough RAM and the processor I wanted, it's like, it's more expensive to do that. You can save money by buying an all-in-one. And it's just...
And it's more compact, and it's better on the desk.
And it's so much nicer to have the design of the iMac than the 5K LG display. I mean, that's a major thing. Even if price was, like, even, you know. Yeah. So, no more 12-inch MacBook. It is in the mail on its way to its new owner. The guy was like, he was really friendly. He was like, does this come with the charger after he won the auction? And like, it was on its, you know, he paid. And I don't think he cared if I had a charger. Like, he was okay with buying his own. It's nice to have a really good eBay experience for once in a while. So, and I'm not trying to like use the iPad to replace the MacBook. Like, I just don't have a portable Mac experience anymore. And the times when I do travel, I just won't have my Mac like workflow. It'll just be, I'm traveling now, I can't do that. And that'll be okay. I think that'll actually be better for like, you know, sanity. So,
fair enough.
Yeah, there's that. And then like worst case scenario, I'm a really big fan of the V and C app screens, mm-hmm. to turn them back into the Mac. And that is better on an 11-inch screen than on a 9.7-inch screen. So
true.
It should be better on 12.9, but like it's fine here. And there are so many things that on a notebook I didn't want to do, like leave certain apps running, have certain apps like refresh more often, or something as simple as try the dynamic desktop on Mojave. And I tried it on the iMac, and it's like there's no battery concern and there's kind of like no resource concern at all.
Yeah.
It's kind of neat. It's only two options, so it's kind of limited. So I didn't use it for more than a few days, but it's kind of neat. but just like functionally, like work-wise, I can have apps that I use like always be at alert and refresh on a cycle that isn't like manual and worry about battery constraint and stuff like that. So really nice, really happy with it. So there's the end of that story.
Well, you sprung that one on me.
Yeah, I did. I just had a question mark on the show notes for the end. So, yeah. There we are. Well, that's the Happy Hour podcast for this week. If you have any feedback, you can email us at happyhour@95mac.com. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach, and follow Benjamin on Twitter at
BZA Mayo.
And we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.